This is the Disability News Program, and I am John Curry, your volunteer reader. Welcome, and thank you for tuning in. In this edition, you'll hear a story from News 5 in Cleveland entitled, I Want to Be Seen for My Art, Not My Disability. I'll be reading a piece from the New York Times about a blind tennis program in New York, and a piece from CBS News in Texas about a blind cricket player. You'll hear an article from Q City Metro entitled Vision Beyond Sight, A Charlotte Man's Journey Through Diabetes, Blindness, and Building Dreams. I'll also be reading the latest from the Disability Scoop and other items. But first up is this piece from the Urban Institute entitled New Trump Policies Targeting Homelessness Threaten the Rights of People with Disabilities. It was written by Susan J. Popkin, Samantha Batko, and Lizzie Ferrara, published August 8, 2025. Between President Trump urging people experiencing homelessness to leave as part of a federal takeover of Washington, D.C., and an executive order directing agencies to prioritize mental health and substance abuse services before other forms of assistance, the administration's stance on people experiencing homelessness is clear. Leave, accept treatment, or go to jail. This policy shift, coupled with sweeping cuts to other social services, is a major departure from long-standing civil rights protections for disabled people, threatening their access to community-based care and increasing the risk of institutionalization, which can severely compromise their well-being. Already, disabled people face multiple intersecting crises when accessing adequate care. About one in four adults in the U.S. have a disability, which makes them more likely to have a lower income and experience discrimination in the private housing market. 18 million people with a disability are eligible for federal housing assistance but are not receiving it. Over a quarter of a million people endure unsheltered homelessness on any given night, and an additional half a million are in shelters. People experiencing homelessness are about twice as likely as other Americans to have a disability, and the share of people experiencing homelessness with a disability is growing. Older adults, who are more likely to have disabilities, increasingly cannot afford housing and are the fastest-growing age group experiencing homelessness. In 2021, nearly 11.2 million older adults spent more than half their income on housing. The new federal actions targeting homelessness, combined with the earlier funding cuts to social programs, raise serious questions about whether disabled people's rights will be recognized or if disabled people will be pushed into institutions under the guise of public safety and cost savings. To ensure disabled people's rights to adequate care, local communities and service systems will need to protect and fund access to services that enable people with disabilities to live independently, services that are already too scarce and too difficult to access. Disabled people and people experiencing homelessness want care, but there isn't enough available. People experiencing homelessness are not homeless because they refuse to access treatment. There simply aren't enough treatment resources available. Untreated substance use or mental health conditions aren't the result of individual failure. They are the product of deliberate policy choices. In the Urban Institute's Los Angeles County Women's Needs Assessment, 46% of women received mental health treatment services but still experienced homelessness, and an additional 24% said they wanted to participate in mental health services but did not receive them. Similarly, one of three women who wanted substance use services did not receive those services. Elsewhere, supportive housing staff members have described their programs as filling a gap caused by the lack of psychiatric and inpatient hospitals, skilled nursing facilities, and in-home caregiving support. These existing gaps in treatment mirror those faced by disabled people and are likely to get worse as new federal legislation takes hold. In a 1999 decision, the U.S. Supreme Court affirmed that people with disabilities have the right to receive services in a setting appropriate to their needs. Centers for Independent Living have long provided supports and structures for disabled adults to be fully included within their communities, emphasizing the dignity that all people deserve. But the 2025 Budget Reconciliation Act made significant cuts to community-based services, reducing the number of appropriate settings available and exacerbating treatment challenges for older adults, people with disabilities, and their families. Medicaid is the largest source of funding for home and community-based supportive services, and the $990 billion in Medicaid cuts could deny services to large numbers of disabled people. At the same time, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services eliminated the Administration for Community Living, ACL, which housed Centers for Independent Living Services and provided funding to states for services to help older adults and disabled people live independently. In 2022, the ACL provided more than 260 million meals to older adults, assistance such as respite care to more than 1.5 million family caregivers, and independent living services to nearly 250,000 people with disabilities. Thousands of ACL civil servants have been laid off, and it is unclear whether or how these critical programs will continue amid the department's reorganization. This leaves older adults and disabled people, including children, to face the real risk of being forced into nursing homes and other types of institutions. Institutionalization will not solve homelessness or provide disability care. Forcing people into treatment, involuntarily institutionalizing people, or putting them in jail will not solve homelessness or people's disability-related challenges. Institutional settings, whether nursing homes, psychiatric facilities, or correctional facilities, strip people of critical rights. Institutionalized individuals are also excluded from federal census counts, which has serious consequences, leading to underestimates of the size of the disabled population, reduced federal resources, and lack of representation in Congress. Further, many nursing homes that rely on Medicaid funding are likely to close, especially in rural areas, leaving people who need care few choices in their communities. Families will have to make decisions about providing care at home, which could mean loss of income for caregivers and economic hardship for the household, or placing their loved ones in faraway facilities. At the same time, immigrant detention and deportation operations, including the rollback of protected status, threatens to decimate the home and nursing home care workforce, as more than a quarter of direct care workers are immigrants. This workforce was already too small and struggling to keep up, and these policy changes risk pushing an already fragile system past its breaking point. Expanding institutionalization while cutting community supports ignores both evidence and lived experience. Disabled people, including those experiencing homelessness, are not refusing care. They are being denied access to it. Community-based services will better address homelessness and protect the rights of disabled people. Solutions to these intersecting crises, homelessness, disability rights, and access to care, already exist. The question is whether we will invest in them. To meet the moment, state and local policymakers need to prioritize the following: restoring and expanding the home and community-based services provided by the ACL to help disabled people and older adults remain in their homes and communities. Protecting the rights of people experiencing homelessness and disabled people to avoid involuntary confinement and to receive care in the most integrated settings appropriate. strengthening the direct care workforce through immigration policies that protect and expand the labor pool, as well as reforms that support higher wages, better benefits, and improved working conditions to stabilize and expand a field that's long been underpaid and overstretched. Funding evidence-based alternatives to institutionalization, which are more humane, more effective, and more cost-efficient than confinement. Investing in affordable, accessible housing, particularly for older adults and disabled people who are disproportionately affected by homelessness and housing instability. These are not radical ideas. They are proven, practical, and urgently needed. Now, here's a piece from the New York Times entitled, "They're Losing Their Vision. They Still Love Playing Tennis." For the visually impaired people who participate in blind tennis, the sport delivers joy. "This is what I've been missing," one player said. By John Leland, published August 15, 2025. Sharon Murphy lived in a house full of books, and when her eyesight started to fail in her 70s, she had to make some changes. The books had to go, thousands of them. There were classes to attend, how to get around her apartment in the city, how to manage paperwork and use a computer. She went to the Metropolitan Museum of Art for a session that helps blind and visually impaired people appreciate the collection. There she heard of something that stopped her: blind tennis. Really? Blind tennis? Ms. Murphy had never played tennis or sports in general, but this piqued her curiosity. "Tell me more," she said. So, on a Saturday morning this spring, she made her way to Sound of Tennis, where blind and visually impaired players convene free of charge at Court 16, a tennis and pickleball club with three branches in New York City. For Ms. Murphy, 81, that first lesson offered more than just tennis. "It opened a world of possibilities," she said the other day, near her home on the Upper West Side. Ms. Murphy has a warm manner and lights up when she talks about her adventures on the court. "Because when you listen to people, it's like, oh, the world is ending," she said, "instead of like, I'm playing tennis." And then all of a sudden you have people's attention, seeing that many things are possible. You don't have to close all the doors and windows. On a recent Saturday at the club, four players took turns learning to hit a ball they could not see. Greg Ganter, the instructor, tossed a slightly oversized, soft tennis ball toward their rackets. "Ready," he said as he released the ball, "and push." Sometimes the players connected, sometimes not. "You hit 2 out of 4 this time," he said, congratulating a woman with retinitis pigmentosa, a collection of degenerative disorders that left her with minimal vision. "That's pretty good." When one player connected solidly, pop, the others celebrated. The origins of blind tennis go back to 1984 in Japan, when a blind teenager named Takai Miyoshi developed a foam ball with a bell inside that players could track by ear. International competition grew across Europe and Asia, but it has been slow to catch on in the United States, even as blind baseball, blind hockey, and a hybrid sport called goalball found followings. When Anthony Everard, a former college tennis player and corporate branding executive, co-founded Court 16 in 2014, he had not heard of blind tennis, but his mother-in-law was legally blind and steered him toward organizations for people with impaired vision. The Sound of Tennis was born. The goal, he said, was not to train players for competitive play, but to enable them to enjoy being on the court, exercising their bodies. "There's a different way to get that joy," he said, "feeling the ball in the strings. That's a win." There is a potentially growing market for that satisfaction. The number of blind or visually impaired people in the United States has increased during the last 30 years and is expected to top 8 million by 2050, according to the National Eye Institute, a part of the National Institutes of Health. Hildegard Morales, who works as an administrative assistant at United Cerebral Palsy, heard about the sound of tennis and wanted to try it once so that she could scratch it off her bucket list along with blind ice skating and bicycling. That was 6 years ago. And I never stopped, she said. Ms. Morales has retinitis pigmentosa and can see only shadows and vague shapes. She feels some urgency to try different activities before she goes totally blind. When she got to Sound of Tennis, she first asked to be led around the perimeter of the court to orient herself in a space she could not see. She found that she liked learning to hit the ball, she said. Just as valuable was spending time with other visually impaired people, including some who had been living with their impairments much longer than she. They come and they're happy and we laugh, she said. And I'm like, this is what I've been missing. It's the village, my new village. And that gave me a little bit more inspiration to say, okay, what can I do for my village? On a recent Saturday, players swapped tips about how to buy sneakers from an online retailer whose search bar was not accessible. Everyone had a horror story about Access a Ride, the city's paratransit service for people with disabilities. Some of the tennis instructions were more effective than others. Mr. Ganter, who usually coaches children without disabilities, occasionally demonstrated his points visually. "Don't let the racket head go like this," he would say to players who could not see what he was doing. The lack of formal training for coaches in working with blind or vision-impaired people has been a shortcoming for the sport and possibly slowed its growth, said Murray Elborn, president of the United States Blind Tennis Association, which works with but is not part of the United States Tennis Association. Mr. Elborn's organization is now pushing for a program to certify coaches. To boost participation in the sport, the organization is hosting a two-hour event at the U.S. Open on August 20 for people to try blind tennis. "We've definitely got a long way to go," Mr. Elborn said. At Court 16 on a later Saturday, two players arrived with relatively low impairments and could hit the ball back and forth with Mr. Ganter. Andy Marks tried hitting the ball with a ball machine, which some players like because it delivers the ball in the same spot each time. Mr. Marks, 36, who works in market research at Audible, had played tennis before his vision suddenly deteriorated in his 20s from a rare genetic disease called Leber hereditary optic neuropathy. But he had not held a racket for a decade before discovering the sound of tennis last year. He compared his vision now to seeing underwater. "Hitting with the ball machine, seeing only a blur on the other side of the net, he had a sudden feeling of playing with his late father," he said. "For him, being on the court was an invitation to push himself, to be more emphatic, not dialed down by his impairment. How much can I do without being able to see the ball?" As for Ms. Murphy, the book lover, that question, how much can she do, is on hold. In late July, she had what she described as a fight with her bedclothes in which she came out on the losing end. Now she was undergoing rehab after surgery for a dislocated shoulder. She particularly missed the support of the other players and the confidence it gave her. Still, she was used to sudden changes and the adjustments they required. She would go back on the court. "Oh, absolutely," she said. "Try and stop me." For now, she said, she keeps imagining she is at the class and wondering what she would be learning. At her last class, the lesson had been serving, and she had not hit the ball once. "I imagine that at some point I'll be able to do a serve." After that, she said, she wanted to try wall climbing. She could not wait to see the looks on people's faces when she told them about it. And now from blind tennis to a blind cricket player. Here's that piece from CBS News entitled, "Legally Blind North Texas Woman Redefines Odds, Named National Finalist After Joining Cricket Team." This was written by Marissa Armas and published August 11, 2025. At the Trimble Tech High School field, 50-year-old Anna Moss begins practice the way she always does. "All right, so this is what we say. Batter ready," said Moss as she practiced her cricket skills. "It hit the wicket. Did it hit the wicket?" But this cricket practice is a little different than most. This is our cricket ball. It has rattles in it, and we use sound to detect where the ball is coming, Moss said. "We shout out audio commands. Here, here, here." That's how a batter will line up to us, or a keeper lines up to us. Moss is legally blind and has been for the last 2 years when she started having nerve issues in her right eye. Moss recalls the moment of her diagnosis. "It was dark. It was hard to accept," she told CBS News Texas. "Hearing the words legally blind was really tough, so I knew my vision was decreasing and it could decrease, but I just didn't realize it would decrease that fast. I felt that without vision, who am I?" But despite her diagnosis, Moss decided she wasn't going to allow it to set her back. "I was diagnosed with cancer kind of all at the same time, kidney cancer, and I had my kidney removed. And that was kind of a rude awakening as well. It was like, I need to get fit, and life is short. So you got to get out there and keep trying," said Moss. And trying, she did. And let alone at cricket, a sport she didn't know much about. How cricket became her saving grace. "Total shock. I was like, cricket? I was like, where did that come from?" said Rick Moss, her husband. "Obviously, I was thinking different things, like most people do. How do blind people play cricket?" Looking for a support group, Moss began scouring social media and found a blind cricket team. It was kind of like, why not? Why not try something new now? Why not try something I know nothing about? And knowing nothing about it and never playing it kind of gauges me from, you know, down here, and little by little I'm climbing that ladder, she said. While it's come with growing pains, Moss said she's learning more about the intricacies of the sport every day, and also about herself. Her commitment to the sport has made her a finalist for the U.S. National Women's Blind Cricket Team. She's also the only Texan. Moss hopes to represent our country at the inaugural Women's T20 World Cup for the Blind in India this fall. Moss's husband said, "So proud of her. Can't imagine how I feel about it. I've learned that I'm stronger than I think I am, than I think I ever was," Moss said. "We've all worked really, really hard, so we all want that. But the journey, I wouldn't trade it for the world." Proving that no matter your age or eyesight, the field is still wide open. "You can do it. You can do it," she said. "I really want them to be energized and encouraged that nothing can stop you." The final roster for the U.S. team will be announced in mid-August. Our next piece comes from News 5 in Cleveland. It's entitled, "I Want to Be Seen for My Art, Not My Disability." This piece was written by Katie Usen, and it was published August 25th, 2025. Cleveland. The Kennedy Center recently brought an annual conference to Cleveland that focused on expanding inclusive arts experiences and environments. It is especially meaningful as the number of Ohioans with vision loss is increasing, according to Prevent Blindness Ohio. Several Northeast Ohio artists were on display at the conference, including Owen McCafferty. McCafferty creates mostly in acrylic, oil pastel, and digital art, and like any artist, he has a signature style. Bold, you know, bold lines and colors. I think that's a way people could recognize that's an Owen McCafferty artwork, said McCafferty. Bold and bright images of sailboats, cityscapes, and birds, all a reflection of how McCafferty experiences and shares the world. "It's a way of expressing myself," he said. What makes his artwork even more remarkable is that McCafferty is legally blind. "I was born visually impaired, and Also, slight cerebral palsy with my face, said McCafferty. The 62-year-old has been creating since childhood. I'd get really close up to the chalkboard, put my face up in it, and draw, he said. That's how they first knew I had some artistic talent. Bold lines and bright colors are easier for McCafferty to see. He said it's meaningful to have his artwork recognized and wants to be seen for his art, not his disability. I want to be an artist and express my artwork, get it out there, and disability should be just secondary, he said. McCafferty was among 7 Northeast Ohio artists whose work was displayed during the Kennedy Center's annual Leadership Exchange in Arts and Disability Conference in Cleveland, a global meetup with a goal of designing more inclusive arts experiences and environments. An example of this is happening at Future Inc. Graphics, a screen printing and digital arts studio in Cleveland. It's really about having these inclusive programs for artists with disabilities and without disabilities, all within the same space, said Stephanie Kluck, owner and director of Future Inc. Graphics. She said that it is important because she believes there are a lot of wonderful artists who are not getting the opportunity to create work. The artists who were on display, including McCafferty, are alumni of FIG's creative residency. The Cuyahoga County Board of Developmental Disabilities provides funding for the program. The artist can really get experience working in a studio space and as a professional artist, said Kluck. To make the artist exhibit during the conference accessible, FIG partnered with Clover Nook Center, one of the world's largest producers of Braille, based in Cincinnati, to create accessible signage that told each artist's name and artwork in Braille and had a tactile QR code with an audio description. There were also tactile graphics of the pieces and a Braille booklet explaining the exhibit. Kluck said, "It's all about making every voice heard in art. I think sometimes artists with disabilities may not be looked at as creating wonderful art and being professional artists," said Kluck. "I love that this can showcase that that's not true and that art is for everyone. I've heard people say that, like, you can't get a job as an artist because you're visually impaired or it's not realistic," said McCafferty. "I've heard comments like that, but I'm just trying to prove them wrong." McCafferty recently started a new job in retail, joking that there is such a thing as a starving artist and he needed to eat. He said he loves making art because it makes him happy, but that's not the only reason. "It makes people happy, not just me, and as long as they appreciate my art, that's all that matters," he said. "I feel blessed." Creating and living, bold and bright. McCafferty said he hopes to show what's possible. Just to encourage others to be creative, even those who may be disabled, he said. McCafferty wanted to give a shout-out to Regina E. Dorfmeyer, a visually impaired Cleveland artist, and John Bramblett of Texas as his inspirations. And now here's a piece from KOAA News in Southern Colorado entitled "Greyhound Under Scrutiny for Alleged Treatment of People with Disabilities." This was written by James Gavato, published August 5th, 2025. Colorado. Greyhound is under federal scrutiny for its treatment of people with disabilities. The Department of Justice has opened an investigation for disability discrimination into Flixx North America Incorporated, the company that owns Greyhound. Greyhound has stops in Colorado, including in El Paso and Pueblo counties. The investigation will look into whether these bus companies denied people with disabilities reasonable accommodations. The Americans with Disabilities Act, ADA, requires companies like these to make sure their services are accessible. The department launched the investigation after receiving several ADA complaints, Some included that these companies did not do the following: maintain lifts, help passengers who needed to use the lifts, allow service animals to ride with them. News 5 checked with El Paso and Pueblo counties to see if anyone had filed complaints through the district attorney's office or the facilities department. As of the publishing of this story, neither county had received any formal complaints. News 5 also asked Greyhound for comment. A spokesperson said the company could not comment on pending legal matters. Just to remind you, this is the Disability News Program on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm John Curry, your volunteer reader. Now back to the program. This next piece comes from Q City Metro. It's entitled Vision Beyond Sight: A Charlotte Man's Journey Through Diabetes, Blindness, and Building Dreams. Shelton Brown was diagnosed with diabetes in 2009. It eventually claimed his vision, but not his ambitions. By Camille D. Ford, published August 6, 2025. Shelton Brown sits in his office surrounded by the rhythms of work: keyboard tapping, phone ringing, papers rustling. In front of him, a tax document rests on the desk. He leans forward and speaks to what looks like an ordinary pair of eyeglasses. "Hey Meta, can you read what's in front of me?" An artificial voice responds, decoding the details Brown's eyes can no longer see. 16 years ago, Brown was spiraling. Diabetes had begun a slow assault on his body, leading to vision loss that would unravel the foundation of his independence. "I cried a lot, was depressed for several years," Brown recalled. The idea of relying on others terrified him. Once a man constantly on the move, raising a son, building a business, navigating life with confidence, Brown suddenly found himself halted, grieving the freedom he once enjoyed. But grief eventually gave way to determination. Today, at age 55, Brown runs Accounting, Consulting, Tax, and Human Resources, a Charlotte business he founded in 2000. He also mentors a growing network of entrepreneurs, and he does it all while managing a chronic condition that disproportionately affects Black Americans. Leon Rock, CEO of the African American Diabetes Association, knows the numbers. Black and African Americans are 1.4 times more likely to be diabetic, he said by telephone. Death rates among diabetics are equally challenged. Rock, himself a diabetic, has spent years understanding how the disease became embedded in Black families. "Many Black families didn't even know they were dealing with diabetes," he said. "They just said, 'She's got the sugar.' That's how it was passed down. Not through education, but through folklore." Brown's story is part of that narrative. "When I did research, I learned my birth mother passed away due to diabetes complications," he said. First diagnosed with diabetes in 2009, he eventually developed glaucoma, then diabetic retinopathy, a condition that occurs when high levels of blood sugar damage blood vessels in the retina, causing them to leak or bleed, a leading cause of blindness for adults with diabetes. "By the time I got proper care, it was aggressive," he said. "It destroyed the nerves in my right eye." Progression was both gradual and sudden, a cruel paradox. "It probably took about 3 years," Brown recalled. "One day I was able to see, and the next day I couldn't." What broke wasn't just his vision. When Brown realized he could no longer do some simple tasks, read a street sign, for example, his identity also crumbled. Then depression settled in, heavy and unrelenting. "I was angry at my support system and the doctor who misdiagnosed me," he said. "I could have saved my vision." Brown said faith and spirituality helped him exit the darkness. "If I stayed angry, I wouldn't be able to help others," he said. "And helping others is what I was put here to do." oddly perhaps, he called his circumstance a gift from God. God gives gifts in so many ways. God says, you're diabetic now. You need to change your lifestyle habits. It's not a death sentence. Necessary adjustments. Living with diabetes meant redesigning how Brown worked, from the tools he used to how he engaged with clients. He learned to use screen readers, magnification software, and eventually, Meta glasses. Most clients don't know I'm visually impaired, he said. I deal with most clients over the phone. The ones I meet in person are shocked when I tell them. His accounting firm processes 1,800 tax returns annually, employs 3 full-time staff, and 20 seasonal workers, mainly servicing Black business owners in their crucial first 5 years of operation. The Meta glasses he received in January 2025 have enhanced his independence. I can tell the glasses to read what's in front of me, and they describe everything, even my surroundings, Brown explained. If I'm somewhere and get lost, I can call someone, and they can see me through my glasses to walk me around an obstacle. A father-son ritual. Brown's son, Shelton Brown Jr., reflects on his father's journey with the perspective of someone who's now a father himself. At age 28, he carries both pride and responsibility as he watches his father navigate with quiet determination. Seeing my dad brings tears to my eyes because there's nothing like having a father like him, Brown said. No matter what I go through in life, I will always need my father. Daily phone calls have become a father-son ritual. I have a special ringtone for my dad, and if I'm in the shower and he's calling my phone, I'm getting out to answer his call. Shelton said the Meta glasses have created an unexpected intimacy with his father. During video chats, the son becomes his father's eyes, guiding him around obstacles and through unfamiliar spaces. He'll video call me and I'll tell him, go left, go right, watch out, he said. I'm like a navigator in his eyes. Shelton admires watching his father live without complaint or self-pity. He gets stuff done regardless of the situation. When it comes to work, he gets down to it. But with family, it's no different. He shows up. Black Wall Street, Charlotte. In 2022, Brown founded Black Wall Street, Charlotte, a hub for Black entrepreneurs. A safe place for business owners to get training and support, Brown said. The model offers mentorship, business training, and financial literacy instructions. Since its launch, the organization has helped launch 20 businesses and impacted more than 100 entrepreneurs. It plans to host a business expo in 2026. The most rewarding part, Brown says, seeing that light bulb go off when someone finally gets it. Equally important is the organization's focus on human well-being. Ambition means nothing without health, Brown said, noting that he walks 10,000 steps daily, monitors his glucose and blood pressure religiously, and follows a careful diet. ROC, with the African American Diabetes Association, echoed Brown's emphasis on health. If I'm not doing the right thing for myself, I'm not doing right for my loved ones and my community, he said. He also advises Black diabetics to advocate aggressively in a medical establishment that too often minimizes Black health concerns. Get yourself a nutritionist and begin to manage your exercise. Do these 3 things and you'll be on your way to controlling your diabetes, ROC said. A vision emerges. Brown said he has a 5-year vision to make Black Wall Street Charlotte a premier Black network for economic empowerment, but his broader goals extend further. He's preparing to launch a podcast called Blinded by Sight. He wants to position himself to be more of a mentor and advocate, especially for folks with disabilities. Let them know that they matter, Brown said. They're not broken. They're still useful and valuable. Next up, we have a piece from the 19th entitled, What It Means to Have a Woman in a Wheelchair, featured on U.S. currency. The late disability justice co-founder and activist Stacy Park Milburn is the first woman in a wheelchair featured on U.S. currency and the first person whose wheelchair is actually shown. This piece was written by Sarah Lutterman. It was published August 21st, 2025. The late disability justice co-founder and activist Stacy Milburn is the latest pioneering woman to receive her own quarter from the U.S. Mint. Milburn is the first woman in a wheelchair featured on U.S. currency and the first person whose wheelchair is actually shown. On August 13, nearly 100 disability advocates, family, and friends gathered at the Smithsonian National Museum of American History to celebrate the quarter's release. Stacy is not the first wheelchair user on currency. President Franklin Delano Roosevelt has been featured on the dime continuously since 1946, but he is presented as a disembodied head. Maria Town, president of the American Association of People with Disabilities, or AAPD, told the 19th. Town pointed out that most Americans did not know Roosevelt used a wheelchair for his entire presidency. She emphasized that the visibility of Milburn's disability is groundbreaking. In showing Stacy's full body, her tracheostomy tube, and her wheelchair as she is in active communication, Stacy's quarter presents an extremely different but more realistic version of disability than has ever been seen on U.S. currency, Town said. Milburn died in 2020 on her 33rd birthday in Stanford, California. The American Women in Quarters program was introduced through legislation in 2021 with bipartisan support. 11,000 women were nominated by the general public to appear on the coins. The U.S. Mint, the National Women's History Museum, and the Smithsonian American Women's History Museum selected 20. Milburn is the second to last in the series. These coins help tell the story of our nation through the remarkable women that helped shape it, and we are proud to help lift up stories like Stacy's, stories that haven't always been included but deserve to be known, Elizabeth Babcock, director of the Smithsonian Women's History Museum, said at the celebration. Stacy was a force for connection and change. She brought people together, connected them around a cause, and organized with purpose. Beth Zebarth, the director of the Smithsonian Office of Visitor Accessibility, and Greg Dawson, U.S. Mint Associate Director for Strategy and Performance, also spoke at the event. Around 200 people RSVP'd, but some said they chose not to attend out of concern about the increased police and military presence in Washington, D.C. Others, who were simply unable to travel due to cost or attend due to health, participated at watch parties across the country. They were joined by Milburn's family, friends, and colleagues, as well as a dance performance from the D-Dim-Say Korean Traditional Art Institute in honor of Milburn's Korean heritage. Milburn's mother, Jean Milburn, highlighted her daughter's work with the Disability Justice Culture Club, an organization Milburn founded that helped get essentials like masks, sanitizer, and even groceries to disabled people who were at the highest risk during the early days of the COVID-19 pandemic. Stacy, being one of the American Women's Quarter honorees, was beyond our imagination. I want to give glory to God for enabling Stacy to accomplish great things, she said. Mia Ives-Rubley, the director of the Disability Justice Initiative at the Center for American Progress think tank, participated remotely due to health reasons. Her initiative is named after the framework Milburn and others created. Her work inspires me continuously to continue to think outside of the current structures, to think about how we can create support networks that aren't just based off of the structures that we have in place today, Ives Rubley told the 19th. Ives Rubley and Milburn first met through the Women's March and National Disability Organizing. We started working together during a time when we were protesting. Some of the disability rights leaders took anti-migrant stances while trying to push disability policy. So we got involved and got to know each other through that, she said. Ives Rubley and Milburn had similar upbringings, something that resonated with Ives Rubley when she began her involvement in disability advocacy. Now, a piece from the Disability Scoop entitled "ABLE Account Rules Updated as Bigger Change Looms" by Michelle Diament, published August 25, 2025. Recent moves by federal lawmakers are set to enhance and expand access to special accounts that allow people with disabilities to save money without jeopardizing Medicaid and other government benefits. Tucked inside President Donald Trump's signature One Big Beautiful Bill Act, which passed in July, are several provisions affecting ABLE accounts. Established under a 2014 federal law, the accounts offer people with disabilities the opportunity to save up to $100,000 without sacrificing eligibility for Social Security and other government benefits. Medicaid can be retained no matter how much is in the accounts. Money saved in the accounts can be used to pay for qualified disability expenses, including education, health care, transportation, and housing. Interest earned is tax-free. A handful of rules governing how the accounts are used were set to expire at the end of this year, but the recent legislation now makes them permanent. That includes the option for ABLE account holders who are employed to save extra money in their accounts if they don't participate in an employer-sponsored retirement plan, as well as the ability to roll over funds from a traditional 529 college savings plan into an ABLE account. That provision is designed to help families that set up college savings plans before knowing their child had a disability. In addition, the recent legislation ensures that ABLE contributions remain eligible for what's known as the Savers Credit. The changes will bring increased confidence in using ABLE accounts, according to Paul Curley of ISS Market Intelligence, which tracks ABLE accounts. As of the end of June, there were 213,855 ABLE accounts open, with $2.68 billion in assets, according to the firm. That's following what the National Association of State Treasurers described as a record year for ABLE accounts in 2024, with the highest year-over-year increase in new accounts and assets. Uptake is expected to grow further when the population of people with disabilities eligible for ABLE accounts expands dramatically next year. Since inception, the accounts have been limited to those with disabilities that onset prior to age 26. Starting in January, however, that age limit will rise to 46, which will increase the estimated number of eligible individuals from 8 million to 14 million. As of earlier this year, the National Association of State Treasurers ABLE Savings Plans Network was already working to prepare and communicate with the public about the broader eligibility, according to Catherine Seat, Communications Director for the organization. Now here's another piece from the Disability Scoop, also by Michelle Diament. It's entitled, "Trump, RFK Jr. Promise Big Autism Announcements." This was published August 27, 2025. U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services Robert F. Kennedy Jr. told President Donald Trump that his agency will have information about what's causing autism within weeks. "We're finding interventions, certain interventions, now that are clearly, almost certainly, causing autism, and we're going to be able to address those in September, Kennedy said during a cabinet meeting Tuesday. In April, the health secretary committed to know what has caused the autism epidemic by September. He later softened his stance, saying instead that we expect to begin to have answers by that point, and that his agency would be initiating studies to identify environmental toxins responsible for autism. During the Tuesday meeting, Trump called autism such a tremendous horror show and asked Kennedy about how autism rates have grown in recent decades. There's something wrong when you see the kinds of numbers that you have today versus 20 years ago, Trump said. So, there has to be something artificially causing this, meaning a drug or something. And I know you're looking very strongly at different things, and I hope you can come out with that as soon as possible. We will, Kennedy responded. Trump insisted that that would be a big day when the forthcoming announcements are made. I think we maybe know the reason, and I look forward to that press conference to be with you in that press conference. That's going to be a great thing, Trump told Kennedy. Autism experts attribute the rise in prevalence to better awareness, improved screening tools and methods, and changes in the diagnostic criteria. The expedited federal effort to uncover what's behind the increase in autism has been met with skepticism by many longtime researchers and advocates, particularly given that Kennedy spent years promoting a link between autism and vaccines, despite numerous studies discrediting that theory. Dr. Helen Tager-Flusberg, director of the Center for Autism Research Excellence at Boston University, who's leading the Coalition of Autism Scientists, a group of more than 300 researchers in the field, said she suspects that Kennedy's announcement will have something to do with vaccines or fluoride, both of which have previously been targeted by David Geer, a vaccine critic who Kennedy hired at HHS. Of great concern is the fact that this is not the way one reports potentially explosive findings to the public, as the president and secretary did today and are planning to next month, Tager-Flusberg said. Rather, she said that researchers go through a peer review process and publish their findings in a reputable journal with documentation so that their study can be replicated. Press conferences presented by a non-scientist, Kennedy, and attended by the president are a way to sensationalize the findings and raise alarm in the public, Tager-Flusberg said. This is not science. And finally, here's a piece from the Disability Scoop entitled Construction Begins on First-of-Its-Kind Apartment Complex for Adults with Autism by Allison Pries, published August 26, 2025, Red Bank, New Jersey. Work has begun on an apartment building in Red Bank specifically designed for adults with autism. The project was approved by Red Bank in the fall of 2023 for a site on Shrewsbury Avenue that contained retail and an apartment building, which are now being demolished. The new 34,000-square-foot building will have 32 one-bedroom units and one ground-floor studio apartment, which will be staffed around the clock. It's expected to be completed in early 2027. We're excited the shovels are in the ground, said Karen Flaherty, who spearheaded the project after an exhaustive search for a place for her son Ryan to live when he aged out of services as a young adult with autism. Flaherty founded Parents with a Plan, a nonprofit that's comprised of parents, families, legal and housing professionals who want to develop solutions for young adults with disabilities. It came up with Thrive Red Bank, a first-of-its-kind neuro-inclusive housing project, which is a private-public partnership between Parents with a Plan and Rutgers Center for Adult Autism Services. Adults with autism arguably have the poorest quality of life than any other community in the U.S., and I think it's time for someone to stand up and do something, said Christopher J. Menenti, executive director of the Rutgers Center for Adult Autism Services. Thrive is a real demonstration of that. Autistic and other neurodiverse people deserve to have beautiful, excellent places to live. Thrive will have low-voltage lighting, gathering spaces that are sensory-friendly, floor drains in the bathrooms to prevent flooding, faucets and ovens that shut off automatically if left on, among other well-thought-out elements to suit its residents. Beyond that, it will be like any other one-bedroom apartment in the area, said John Klein, managing partner of Thrive Red Bank, who has decades of executive experience in real estate development. I think that's very important. Thrive will also have on-site support services, and Rutgers Center for Adult Autism Services employee will be there Monday through Friday as a resource for the 32 residents and their families to ensure they're getting the support they need and meeting the life outcomes they hoped to achieve, Menenti said. And there will be a round-the-clock support person who will live in a ground-floor studio apartment. Rent for the market value units will be about $5,000 per month, Flaherty said. This isn't just the first building of its kind in New Jersey. There's nothing else like this in the world, Menenti said, adding that others do bits and pieces, but the extent of services and the public-private partnership is one of a kind. Demolition of an office building at the site was expected to begin this month, while Thrive continues securing construction permits, Klein said. Red Bank was chosen because of its walkability, job and volunteer opportunities for Thrive residents, and its cultural and educational offerings. It's very well-rounded with a variety of experiences, Klein said. There are at least 200,000 people in New Jersey who have intellectual or developmental disabilities, according to a market analysis study commissioned by Parents with a Plan. About 73% live with family, and 38,000 of them live with a caregiver who is over the age of 60. Thrive had nearly 50 applicants before construction began. The demand overwhelmed and really humbled me, Flaherty said. 27 of the 32 units at Thrive will be market rate, and 5 will be affordable units. Applications for the affordable units will not be open until 6 months before construction is completed. Applications for the market rate units are still being accepted. All potential tenants will have to go through a clinical assessment with Rutgers Center for Adult Autism Services. That concludes the Disability News Program for this time. Thank you for joining us, and please join us again next time.